This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and 90.9 FM HD2. We're also online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Who are America's Latinos? They find themselves portrayed as hardworking and family-oriented. Alternately, they're portrayed as a tax burden and a threat to the jobs of other Americans. While the debate rages over immigration, Latinos are wooed for their votes and courted as consumers. As our guest today asks, are Latinos America's scapegoats or the belle of the ball? On the program today, we'll try to go behind and beyond these characterizations. Anthropologist Arlene Davila is our guest. She is the author of Latino Spin, Public Image, and the Whitewashing of Race. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a telephone call this afternoon. I invite your questions and comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Our guest, Arlene Davila, is professor of anthropology and American studies at NYU. Her previous books include Barrio Dreams, Puerto Ricans, Latinos, and the Neoliberal City, and Latinos, Inc., Marketing and the Making of a People. Professor Davila's, new book, Latino Spin, Public Image and the Whitewashing of Race, is published by New York University Press. Again, our phone numbers, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Professor Davila, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you so much for the invitation.
Yeah. Early in the book, you say, you know, you're concerned that Latinos are being characterized, in your words, in a more marketable, sanitized, and compensatory way. And you suggest a shifting place. They're holding a shifting place in the politics of race. What is underway?
That's a very good question. And yes, I was referring to, a new trend that I had been witnessing, revolves around, particularly triggered since the census 2000 showed Latinos outnumbering African Americans as the number one minority, but also a trend triggered by the immigration debate, right, that has caused so many fears in society about how will Latinos affect American culture, right? There's been this growing tendency among advocacy advocates and politicians and people to basically contend that, you know, there's really nothing to be afraid with Latinos. You know, Latinos are hardworking American. They're actually more American than regular Americans. Because they actually have conservative values that Americans have lost. So you have these kinds of glossy images trying to quell the fears that I think are very troubling because they really limit the Latino experience in this country, and they really portray a kind of caricaturistic view of Latinos as a new model minority that is very inaccurate, I contend.
Yeah. Well, what are the consequences of being sanitized and whitewashed?
Well, one of the there's many consequences, but I think it sort of provides a very skewed image of Latinos coming of age and mainstreaming and in American society that is very comforting to many of us, but it also veils and the ways in which Latinos continue to be subordinated and things Latino continue to be subordinated at the same time that Latinos are so-called joining the ranks of mainstream culture. And that's what I'm trying to highlight in the book, is to sort of say, yes, of course, many Latinos are now middle-class homeowners doing well. You know, they're joining the ranks of so-called mainstream culture. But that shouldn't veil the ways in which, when we look at all the economic statistics, and Latinos continue to lag behind white Americans. Now, why is that? Mm-hmm. And also, when we think about, what does it mean to be mainstream or to be said that we are, you know, part of American culture when we still have these incredible fears about immigration or incredible fear about immigrants. I'm sorry, not immigration, but both. And also, when we actually look at all these spaces of that claim to where Latinos are so-called have made it, right? And in the book, I go into the realm of politics, where I show that regardless of the rise in numbers, Latinos continue to be greatly misrepresented as voters, but also as political elected officials and appointed officials. So I want to sort of create a more kind of realistic kind of, well, you know, it's not time, it's still not time to be, it's still too early to be embracing these figures, these ideas of coming of age. And I wanted to sort of provide a kind of intervention to those images, because I think that we are, in the Latino community is very eager to have those kinds of positive images circulated, mm-hmm. because they address the long-standing stereotypical representation of Latinos as crime-ridden, as poor-stricken, as immigrants. So all of us are very eager to have positive images being reproduced. And I want to sort of explore what's at stake when, you know, the political implications of upholding and embracing those images uncritically.
Yeah, one of the issues that concerns you, or one issue that concerns you, is the view that an image of upward mobility is desired and or required in order to be recognized.
Absolutely.
So on the one hand, it's a good thing to have these images out there, because they can lead to more clout, for lack of a better word.
Mm-hmm.
They lead to visibility. On the other hand, they're problematic.
Yes, and I sort of try to frame these new representations in light of a wider climate, political climate, that, you know, people in scholarships, in the scholarship have begun to talk about, you know, the rise of color blindness and neoliberalism. You know, we live in this kind of society where, you know, poverty is not popular. It's not, you know, we have to be upper mobile. We have to be entrepreneurial, and groups have to show their ability to be entrepreneurial in order to count as American citizens. We live in a context where groups have to prove their worthiness as constituencies, mm-hmm. that either provide votes or that provide that have a marketing value, that could buy consumer goods, and it's only in that light that groups can then present themselves to the political table and say, we value and we're here and we are, you know, we belong and we're American, and that sort of I argue that it shows a shift in the political. You know, in the political climate of what the kinds of thing of the political climate of what can be talked about and in what terms,
mm-hmm.
so that poverty becomes a liability, or talking about social needs becomes a liability, and it's only in regards to these kinds of proving one's worthiness, and that groups can become stakeholders, right, of the in the political realm. So I show that. You know, that's one of my warnings in the book, is what this means is that it requires us to be sometimes complicitous with policies and politics that are not, you know, not to the benefit not only of Latinos, but also of most working class Americans, for that matter, right?
Yeah.
Because we cannot bring attention to issues of needs, to, you know, whether it's education, you know, it's like the old violin. You don't want to be sounding that violin. That's like a discourse of the past, right? The 60s or 70s, you know. We're now new. We're stakeholders, and so it's sort of that. I don't know if this answers your question, but I was sort of my warning concerns the larger political climate of what can be said and what cannot be said, and how citizens have to be shiny and new in order to be heard.
Yeah, how does all of this affect our response as a country to poverty?
Exactly. That's a very good question, because the argument goes, you know, if Latinos are middle class and becoming homeowners, and it's interesting because now we are in a moment of shift, and it's interesting to see how there's sort of a change to that kind of political neoliberal climate that has been so strong. Because the recession, right, is finally breaking the seams and exposing that we're all hurting, but some of us are hurting more than others. So issues of race and class are again coming to the forefront. So it's going to be very interesting, because we're at a moment where it'll be interesting to see, because we're at a moment we cannot be denying these realities in American society. But absolutely. when we uphold these images of upper mobility in the Latino population, and we tend to oftentimes use them as, look, you know, there's this Latinos are doing well, then, you know, if even Latinos are doing well, there's really not a problem to address. So what I do in the book is sort of highlight not only the creation of these kinds of positive spin, but also the political uses and what's at stake when they become sort of normalized in regards, when we can point to a black middle class or a Latino middle class, their existence as a reason why there's really not a problem in terms of our economic system, right, or issues of social welfare.
Yeah, it's interesting, as you note, the Latino middle class is held up as being vibrant, while overall the middle class is currently described as being under duress.
Exactly. That would be a very good example. That would be a good example. And I think it also has to do with the way in which the immigration debate has really affected the way in which it really has created this kind of wider climate where, you know, where we cannot talk about Latinos because the moment you talk about Latinos, they summon the fears, right? So there is this kind of emphasis among many of the advocacy community to prove, right, and go out of the way to show that we are not a liability, that we are contributing and reinvigorating American society either through our economic power, purchasing power, and our votes and so forth. And it's that trend that I try to highlight. It's like, but it's because, you know, Latinos have become such an incredible liability. You know, when you talk about Latinos, immediately what's become summoned is the immigration debate, and we saw it in the past couple of years. So in my view, that's one of the reasons why, you know, it's important to sort of deconstruct a little bit of this, you know, celebration that oftentimes we see voice from the, at the level of advocacy institutions or political politicians, right?
Is there a path, another path in America other than upward mobility to political currency and clout?
That's a very good point. And I think that, you know, issues of, you know, hardworking and entrepreneurship and there's such, you know, central canons of the American, right, Anglo-American spirit, right, the conduits, you know, become those. And so we have this kind of, the development of this kind of model minority tropes that emerge often. And so I think that this is what's happening with Latinos. It's not necessarily new. It's just that it's very different. And because Latinos are not any other ethnic group in this country. And that's one of the things that I also go into in the book. A lot of the arguments that posit Latinos as a model minority usually apply the European model of assimilation, you know, that apply to Italians or Irish Americans or Eastern Europeans to Latinos. And ignoring the differences, historical, political, and economic differences between the incorporation of Latinos in this country and former immigrants. So the model minority myth doesn't quite apply to Latinos. It's sort of very slippery. It never sticks. It never sticks fully because it you know, we have to deal with a racialized history. And that's one of the things that I go into the book, is how do we begin to not lose sight of the way in which race and racism operate when Latinos are concerned.
This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, anthropologist Arlene Davila. She is a professor of anthropology and American studies at NYU, and we're talking with her this afternoon about her book, Latino Spin, Public Image and the Whitewashing of Race. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. The thing about talking about Latinos and thinking about things that are slippery is the Latinos are not a monolith. One can be Latino with African roots. One can be Latino with European roots. Maybe it would be useful to talk a little bit about what these terms mean, how useful they are, and where we begin maybe to get into a little trouble with them.
Yes, that's a very good point. And that's Latinos, as we know, are made up, it's a very diverse group made up of people, different nationalities, racial backgrounds, even linguistically, right? We tend to think, oh, Latinos all speak Spanish, and, you know, what happens with all of the Mexican indigenous population that also, that, you know, does not speak Spanish and is also part of that group. And also politically and in class terms, religious, in terms of religion also, Latinos have been moving to evangelical sects, so the notion of Catholics, you know, so there's a lot of diversity in the community. What I'm trying to, and also especially in terms of racial background, right? Now there are increasingly more recognition for Afro-Latinos and Indo-Latinos or indigenous background Latinos and so forth. And so it begs the question, how can we think about issues of race when Latinos, you know, come from all this variety of backgrounds, and including also many white Latinos, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what's really interesting and why it's important to sort of bring attention to issues of race is because I think Latinos push us to rethink how we think of race in this country,
mm-hmm.
because we have tended to sort of take refuge on the path, on the idea that, you know, we live in this kind of bipolar black and white, right? And that, you know, black and white, and then that's sort of slipping away, and now we have all these, you know, diverse groups, and because we're moving away from this kind of bipolar, that therefore we're no longer, you know, race is no longer a problem in American society because we're so diverse. And Latinos have been used oftentimes to make that argument, right, because Latinos are so numerous, and this notion that Latinos are going to forever change the way we think about race and are going to move us to a more harmonious integration, some argue. And what I try to show in the book is the ways in which Latino is a very racialized construct, because irrespective of, you know, background, you know, how do we think about Latino incorporation in this country, irrespective, as a racialized experience that is not necessarily coded in racial terms? And I think that that's what Latinos teaches us, are able to help us think about, is how race operates not only through a specific color, right, or pigmentation, but also through ideas of culture, ideas of, you know, who belongs more or less, and ideas of who is more likely to be considered American. And even with Latinos, what I try to show is how, you know, racism in our own community, and how when we uphold this image of, you know, Latino coming of age, is a particular definition of Latino that becomes mainstreamed, which is that which resembles most the kind of normative white American vision of Latino. And actually, the Spanish media, television, Latino media is a very good example of this, where you, if you turn the Spanish media, you would see the kind of, you know, light-skinned Latino that is taken as the norm, in irrespective of so what I'm trying to highlight is that Latino is very racially coded and implicated because of the racial hierarchies that are erased. And when we think about Latino in this country, we tend to erase the black Latinos. Mm-hmm. We tend to erase the indigenous Latinos. We only think about this kind of more glossy image of kind of light skin, not too dark, not too white Latino, that is racially coded, but also how we forget the ways in which even the whitest of all Latinos can be subject to racial exclusion if they don't fully resemble the kind of, like, my accent is a good one. You know, if you see me, I'm a light-skinned Latina, and I could tell you that my accent will be, it has been and can be easily racially coded irrespective of my background and education. So I think that what Latinos help us is to think about how culture, and, you know, all the varieties of culture, which includes, you know, accents, language, behaviors, can become racialized in our society and are, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's why we make so many distinctions in this country that you know, beyond black and white.
Yeah. I think somewhere in the book you say we are machines for making distinctions.
That's correct. and all of us, actually, not only Americans, but humans. That's where anthropology comes in, right?
Yes. Well, apparently it's meant something for our survival to size one another up, friend or foe, right?
And it basically is a way of classifying. And it goes back to distinctions we made for class, because that's another variable we don't talk about in our society, right? We don't talk about race so much, but we talk sometimes a lot more about race and class. Class is another variable that is all over us, but we don't have the language to talk about, yet we constantly are making assessments in regards to, you know, the brand of jeans that people are wearing, the kind of latte that people drink, right? All these markers of class around us that we are constantly taking into consideration for classifying and making distinctions, yet we live in a, you know, we're all middle class, right? So I think it's important to sort of, and you know, the same happens with race, is how do we begin to account for those distinctions we make and acknowledge when those distinctions are used to create more inequalities as opposed to not talk about those distinctions.
Yeah. And not to put too much of a fine point on it, but we're always sizing one another up. And part of it also is our interest in one another, genuine interest. You know, what do you do for a living? Where do you live? Where do you go to church? So on and so forth. But as you say, these questions about our economic standing, about our education, about our occupation, about our beliefs, really play a role in how we see one another and how we treat one another.
Yeah, and that's why actually I felt that instead of talking about representations, it was important for me to, and I do this in the book, is to look at examples of how this plays out in particular settings, right? And I go, one of the chapters talks about urban planning in New York City, where I'm looking at the gentrification of neighborhoods that used to be Latino, that are Latino, right? And as an example of the way in which it's important to sort of be attentive to the kinds of Latino culture that is being advanced. That's one example where you see Latino development or Latino-themed developments being summoned and celebrated and talked about. But then when you look about the kind of Latino culture and who is behind the developments and whether communities are included as stakeholders, whether, you know, you have the hiring of Latino architects or the hiring of Latino workers or visions that actually incorporate community visions of what a Latino development should be, when you actually tease out, right, that which is regarded as all as examples of Latino incorporation in American society, what you find is that more likely than not, you have developments that are more commercial or that are resemble more the kind of, you know, mainstream idea of, you know, normative culture, and that really do not include Latinos, so that the Latinos become are appealed to symbolically, but not really as stakeholders. And the same happens on the media, where you have a lot of celebration about Latino media, but you realize that Latinos own less media than they did 10 years ago. So that Latino ownership, you know, you have less Latino ownership of the media, but more Latino advertising, right? So that's the key of trying to sort of highlight, you know, ask questions of what's behind the representations, who's making money out of this representation, who is included and who is excluded. Those are the questions and the examination that I try to do in the book, is to sort of show how this plays out on the ground.
Why less Latino ownership of media? Is that the larger, does that involve the larger media ownership question we've seen across the board in this country over the last several years now?
Absolutely. The same trends towards consolidation and centralization and fewer has also affected Latinos, and you have it on the radio, and so you have more media but in less hands. It's the same process. So so when we celebrate Latinos as a market, I think it's important to say what that means in terms of who's profiting from that incredible growth of Hispanic marketing. is that money is going to particular corporations. It's not going to communities. And I think it's that connection between what gets produced and who is right, who's profiting from those representations, or who is part of those representations, and Latinos in particularly have become more and more involved as consumers rather than as producers of TV shows, owners of the media. And that I could go on talking about that because that's one of my pet peeves here.
If we take it as a good that it's good to have lots of stakeholders out there, how do we make people stakeholders in such areas as urban development, in schools, and so on and so forth?
Yeah, that's a very good question. In the area, I mean, the book talks about three examples of community representation. One is museums, the other one is urban planning, and the other one is the academic field. But so I think that the same questions come up, you know, and the media, of course, right, the mm-hmm. media. But I think the media is a very good example, I think, because it's just such an important engine, economic engine in our society. And it goes back to that the media provide a very good example of the connection between representations and policies, because the representation of Latinos as consumers is that they are a Spanish-language constituency that you could only address through Telemundo or the Spanish-language media, right? And that has been the normal definition of the Latino consumer. You address to Telemundo, I'm sorry, to Univision and the kind of Spanish-language world. And that's one representation that has historically sustained the importation of programs from Latin America. You don't have U.S.-born Latino talent being incorporated as producers, as writers, as talent. So when you turn the Spanish-language media world, you have, you know, it represents a big constituency of the Latino population, but primarily the Spanish-language dominant population, to the exclusion of, you know, of many of U.S.-born Latinos, second generation, third generation. So it means that some of my students, for instance, who are U.S.-born Latinos who want to go into Latino media would have less opportunity to join in than, for instance, someone who comes directly from Latin America and speaks Spanish, you know, correctly according to. So it's one space where we are unable to, where some of us can cash in, but others cannot cash in as stakeholders and participants because of the way in which we have reduced the definition of the Latino consumer to be that which speaks Spanish and can be addressed to Spanish language television. But that also is because these media are so powerful, and they're all actually owned by, they're all not owned by Latinos either. So that's one example where you have a lack of stakeholder ownership, but also a lack of involvement and participation, and a big gap between the Latino community and the people that are advancing or producing representations of Latinos for Latinos. And when you talk to people in the media activists, they tend to say that Latinos are second-class citizens twice. And they say so because they're not represented in the regular mainstream channels, but also they're not represented in the so-called own media. Either of those spaces, oh, well, Latinos have their own media, and nobody's really targeting that other diverse category of Latinos who speak English, for instance.
Hmm. Do you think your students might address that problem one of these days?
Well, there are many of them want to join the world of marketing. And media. So I'm really hoping. The problem is the way in which the political economy, the incredible economic interests that are behind sustaining, because it's so profitable to keep this idea of the Spanish language media as the only space for Latino representation, that it becomes difficult. And that's what I'm trying to highlight, is the economic interests that tend to support one idea of Latinos because it's profitable. But and the consequences of that for the rest of the population and including my students. That's correct.
Yeah, and it's not good for not good for the country as a whole, Latino or not, I would say. Right? Aren't we all in this together?
No. Yeah. No. Absolutely. And what's exciting about today is that we can actually raise these questions. And I think that the more that we are get used to the fact that Latinos, you know, are here and are part of, you know, are American citizens, and that they should be, you know, they should be in NBC and ABC and Fox News, right? They should be represented everywhere. The better it would be, but, you know, I don't know if we're still there yet, but it's that notion that, you know, we still need something specific for Latinos, because otherwise, you know, they're this kind of containment of things Latino, you know, that I think that is great in terms of providing a space for representation, but oftentimes maintains Latinos sort of in their place with their culture, with their channel, with their things, and inhibits us from sort of fully participating, you know, as stakeholders, you know, in all aspects of American culture, which we are.
Yeah. How and where were Latinos courted by Republicans and Democrats in our most recent election?
Yeah, what was interesting about the last election is how little Latinos were courted compared to the 2004, and that was what was most significant. Because in 2004, I mean, if you remember, there was an incredible, the largest amount in investment in targeting Latinos. Bush even had like a whole campaign, you know, ads in Spanish. It was incredible. And what was interesting to me is how all of a sudden Latinos became this kind of constituency that nobody wanted to touch because of the immigration debate, right? They became almost a political liability, where they were really, you know, the comparison between 2004 and the last election was very poignant. And to me, it was very revealing because of the ways in which we're so eager to sort of embrace Latinos, but then erase them, right? We tend to discover them in the elections, but then we sort of erase them altogether after the elections have passed. And I think the past elections, you know, both parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, were significantly noted for the lack of Latino outreach compared to the 2004 election. And I think that was indicative of the political climate.
Mm. What kinds of views are held regarding the debate over immigration by Latinos? And here, I guess, again, we get at the idea that Latinos are not monolithic. There's a lot of diversity.
That's correct. And they were there are also many Latino groups that also embrace the same kind of discourse that we see in the ultra right about Latinos and immigration. And this is many groups that say many Latinos who this has a history, of course, you know. The idea that all Latinos are pro-immigration, actually, as a general group, the polls do show that Latinos tend to be more generally pro-immigration than other segments of society. However, within that group, you have many Latinos who are upholding very dearly to the distinction that they're not immigrants, that they have nothing to do with immigrants, that they've been in this country for 300 generations, and that they're more American than the Americans, and the only reason why they're not Americans is because this hordes of immigrants continue to step into and sort of crowd their space, if you will, right, and sort of break that's one of the reasons why I wanted to expose a lot of this coming of age, and we're doing so great, because I also felt that it was a kind of representation that was very much embraced by many Latino groups against immigration, that are the first ones to distance themselves from their forebears, if you will. So I think that's one of the things that inspired me to do the book, is to sort of highlight that many of us embrace these kinds of discourses that we're great, we're fine, we're middle class. If you just stop the floats of immigration, then we will be American. Many of us think that the only reason why Latinos have not fully mainstream is because immigration. And what that does is it forgets and erases the ways in which, irrespective of immigration, Latinos in this country continue and thinks Latino continue to be subordinated because of racial difference, cultural difference. So it's a position that elides racism and that sort of blames it all on immigration, uses immigrants as the scapegoat for all the problems that we all Latinos face, forgetting that it's the problems Latinos face are better than immigration, are bigger than immigration, and it really concerns the racial race in this country and whether Latinos would be allowed to be fully American citizens, you know, in the sense of citizenship, you know, with all of the meanings of citizenship. But many of us are very, very easy and very eager to sort of blame immigrants for all of our problems, which I try to say it's ill-founded.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Arlene Davila. She is professor of anthropology and American studies at NYU and the author of Latino Spin, Public Image and the Whitewashing of Race. My name is Celeste Quinn. We have about 10 minutes remaining in this portion of the program. Listeners, if you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Let's take a call now from a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. My question, I guess comment, has to do with the way we've been talking for the last 30 minutes, which is a generalized word of Latinos, as if we were one group. We haven't yet spoken, especially here in the Midwest, we have to segment who Latinos, who the Latino groups are, as slightly mentioned, by language, choice, by voting, in Dr. Davila's book, about the the misinterpreted numbers of the Latino vote in the 2004 election. It seems to me that real problems like the census having a check mark for Latino and then not having a race category that adequately reflects the variety of different types of people that would like to check off something, you know, a mixed category, but we were all, as a Latino myself, very hesitant to click off anything because it was misrepresenting who I identify with. So I guess my question would be, tell us more about these groups and why they are not a group, so that we don't fall into the same trap as media of the media. I mean, radio, the influence of radio in Spanish-speaking Latino groups is huge. As much as Univision, radio is listened to all across the country, but they're not mentioned as a media source. So anyway, I'd like the conversation to direct itself a little bit towards the many different kinds of Latinos and why it's important instead of speaking of us as a group.
Yeah, I think that the listener is right on target. And the book is called Latino Spin for a reason, because I wanted to go and expose the fact that, yes, we're not just one group, but we are in the eyes of politicians, pundits, think tanks, media, marketers, and so forth. The creation of Latinidad, or one group out of many, many groups, is taking a pace in this society by very powerful institutions that are creating this image to their, you know, in whatever image, you know, most make them more money, more votes. So it's really in that regard that I'm highlighting that kind of top-down definition of Latinos. That doesn't mean that we on the ground do not recognize the differences, but that also means that also us in the ground, whether we are Mexicans, Latinos, I'm sorry, Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, Dominicans, we also don't recognize or identify with that category in certain moments more than others. So I think we on the ground who have Latino background identify the subtlety and the politics behind that in ways that are far more sophisticated than any of the institutions that I refer to in the book. So I think that you're right on target. My aim, however, is to sort of show the way in which Latino as an undifferentiated grouping is created, constructed, and used. Because I think that by saying that Latino does not exist doesn't really address the fact that, you know, every year millions of dollars are being targeted for Latino marketing, for instance, or that politicians are not using that category as a meaningful category. So I acknowledge the diversity, but I'm trying to sort of expose the ways in which this kind of Latino top-down generic identity is being created at the same time. I don't know if that responds to your question, but talking about diversity of Latinos, my goodness, we could spend three programs, actually.
Does a listener want to follow up?
Yes, I'm still here. I understand that the top-down definition and what how it's being used, exploited even, and I understand the reason for that, but as I was reading your book, I am concerned about the lack of detail of who these groups are, so that as we approach that big category of Latinos that many of us did not identify with until it's become the default, we create a false sense of unity, and even the demographic category that I mean, Spanish-speaking Latinos are one group, the English-speaking Latinos are another group, and we cross only at home momentarily. So thank you for coming to that or addressing that further.
Yeah, I look forward, Juan, I think the Midwest is such an incredible laboratory, I have to say, and a lot of my examples are based in New York City. And I think that in the book I sort of highlight the kind of diversity of New York City Latinos and how that sort of tapped into. But I agree that, you know, the Midwest and the Southwest and in Miami, you know, we also have the regional diversity. And I think that in each instance, you know, I'm sure Juan can write his own book also about how this plays out from your experiences. And I think that that's what's exciting is we don't have enough of those narratives reaching the mainstream, unfortunately. And I think we need a lot more of that as opposed to this kind of top-down visions, you know, which I'm just identifying to sort of critique them. But I don't think, you know, an author, I think we need a lot more documentation of what, you know, of the diverse experience on the ground. I agree.
Let's take another call now. A listener also in Urbana, line two. Hi.
Hi. I just want to say that from listening to what you're saying and from my own observation, wouldn't it be that language would be the problem? Whereas, you know, we're a multinational country as well as racial, and we all speak English. So maybe that might be the reason why there's so much of a problem in those areas that you've been talking about, media and stuff, because of the fact that we are an English-speaking country, and everyone should be speaking English. And maybe that's the problem. I'm just throwing that in there as a question and an observation.
Yeah, no, I think you raise a very important point, because one of the things that we see is this kind of Janus-based treatment to Latinos, because, you know, we have this kind of, you know, resistance to Spanish in public. Yet American corporations, you know, spend millions of dollars in advertising to Latinos in Spanish. So I think what's interesting and is how, you know, we have in this country a kind of, you know, disjunction, right, between the political terrain where, you know, we can't say certain things. We have to, you know, we all have to be, you know, the same, and we all have to be English-speaking, and then the economic and the marketing realm that has become the number one spokesperson for Latinos because they can make so much money out of them, right? So what I do in the book is say, well, you know, how about trying to make an alignment, a more direct alignment between the economic interests of this country and the political interests of this country to perhaps come up with a medium space where we're not celebrating things, you know, in Spanish, advertising them in Spanish, but then we don't address the issue of Spanish in public life, right?
Hmm. We have to wrap up here, and I can only give you about 1 minute. But here, I think, to wrap up, talk with us, if you might, a little bit about a better model of assimilation for Latinos in the United States. Earlier, you talked about the shortcomings of the European model. What would a better model look like be in this case?
Well, I think that, you know, we tend to measure assimilation on the basis of one variable. I think your listener just identified one, right? You know, if people spoke English, then there wouldn't be any problem, right? So we tend to sort of limit it to, well, to one variable, you know, whether it is speaking English or owning a home or moving to suburbia or becoming evangelical. One variable that means that Latinos are moving upwards. And I think that what we really need to come to terms is realizing that I think all of us, anybody, not only Latinos, but everybody in society wants to be part of. Nobody, you know, assimilation, you know, who doesn't want to be part of, you know, and everybody wants to uphold. It's this notion that we need to realize that the problem of assimilation is, in my view, is it doesn't account for the ways in which some groups are allowed to belong more than others. And I think that we need to be alerted to that and not sort of blame groups for not assimilating or holding on to their culture. I think we need to have a better understanding that accounts for the ways in which in our society we still welcome some groups to the American national political table more than others. And I think it's addressing that issue of you know, how do we, who we let in and who we don't, in a more broader way, will get us to, you know, be beyond this impasse of how do we measure people's assimilation.
Yeah.
So look whether it's one variable.
Yeah, look around and see who's at the table.
Exactly.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Professor Davila, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program has been Arlene Davila. She is the author, most recently, of Latino Spin, Public Image and the Whitewashing of Race. The publisher is New York University Press.